Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. And a man who has been on both sides in that war is our first guest. He is Dr. Tawfiq Hamid, medical doctor by training, but a man who formerly was associated with Jamaat Islamiyah in his native Egypt. He worked with Ayman al-Zawahiri, now the leader of al-Qaeda. He knows from inside the belly of the beast the danger posed to all of us by radical Islam. This is the subject of a book he has written entitled Inside Jihad, Understanding and Confronting Radical Islam. Today, Tawfiq is a senior fellow and chair for the study of Islamic radicalism at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies. Tawfiq, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Pleasure to be with you, Frank.
I'd like to start by drilling down with you about a group that I believe objectively is very much at the forefront of Islamic radicalism, as you call it, inside jihad, for that matter. The Muslim Brotherhood is an outfit that is being treated as, responsible interlocutors, indeed go-to resources for the Obama administration. Is that a serious strategic error?
Of course it is a serious strategic error, because it seems that the administration does not know anything about the phenomena of radical Islam. If they analyze the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood, it's not much different from any jihadi group. All what the Brotherhood are doing is they represent the nice face, smiley face of the jihadi group that can sit with you on table and pretend that they are civilized. However, the reality on ground is showing the opposite. For example, when Mohamed Morsi came to power in Egypt, he released the radical jihadists from the prisons who are now currently causing troubles in the country. And number two, he invited many of the killers of President Sadat to his palace, and then even to celebrate the 6th October war celebration. So he invited them to his palace. And after the June 30 revolution, many of the leading members of this group actually clearly stated that the terrorism in Sinai will stop only and immediately if Mohamed Morsi came back to power. So you deal with a group that is very affiliated with the radical groups. They do not object to any of their teaching, and they just play the most dangerous game. In fact, they are more dangerous than the jihadists, because the jihadists are clear that they are violent, barbaric people, but these people are the ones who are behind the money, finance, and support, and the gradual infiltration, which can be more dangerous to our society and to the world than the clearly apparent jihadists that you can fight, because you know they are evil.
I couldn't agree with you more, Tawfiq, and that's one of the things that I was particularly anxious to hear from you. These guys are, as one of my colleagues, John Guandolo, is fond of saying, the nicest guys in the room. That's part of the trade craft. But they are, in fact, particularly in the West, where they are not opposed to violence. It's just they don't feel strong enough to engage in it. Instead, performing a kind of what they call civilization jihad. And I couldn't agree with you more that that is at least as dangerous to democratic polities like ours as is the violent kind. Talk, if you would, a little bit about what it means in Egypt at the moment, as President al-Sisi is clearly trying to grapple with a host of very serious economic and other demographic problems, and the Muslim Brotherhood now in a very, well, they call it a new phase in which they are expecting a long and uncompromising struggle, and they pray for martyrdom. What does it mean to an al-Sisi that the U.S. government is embracing these guys, meeting with them in the State Department, meeting with their American front organization leaders in the White House?
It simply means that the U.S., based on this attitude that you just mentioned, is is interested in supporting radical Islam rather than the other way around. And in simple words, instead of taking the most logical thing that most Americans actually want, which is to defeat radical Islam, they are actually encouraging it. The more they embrace the Brotherhood, the more they allow them to sit with them on table, the more it's creating pressure on Al-Sisi, and not only that, it's encouraging the radicals to become more radical. That is the phenomena that many need to understand here in the U.S., that the psychological factors here play a major role. When they see you here in America accepting and celebrating the Muslim Brotherhood, the people, they do not stop their terrorism and they increase it. So what President Obama is doing here is actually aggravating terrorism in the Middle East and aggravating the violence. And they need to know this, that their actions here causes a lot of trouble there. And if they do not stop such accommodation for the Brotherhood, they should not expect anything, but things will get much worse and worse.
You know, Tawfiq, I'm struck by a kind of element of Quranic teaching that says when, you know, you see the infidel submitting, the appropriate response is to make them feel subdued. So it's as you say, a prescription for more jihad, more violence to effect this sort of permanent dimitude.
Concessions from your side can only aggravate the problem. You need to have a clear stand beside someone like Sisi, who stood for the first time in our history of the Middle East to see a leader standing in front of the Islamic scholars eye to eye, a few meters away from them, telling them clearly we need a revolution in Islam. And he was talking here about the violent religious teaching. So when you have some guy like this, you need to support him fully rather than trying to do the opposite and support his opponent as if the U.S. that used a lot of taxpayer money to fight radicalism in Afghanistan and as they say, and in Iraq as well, they are the ones, the same leaders who are, or not the same ones, I mean individually, but it seems very schizophrenic to, on one hand, spend all this money to fight Islamic radicalism, and on the other hand, not to stand beside President Al-Sisi in his war against the radicals. This seems to be very ironic and bizarre.
Tawfiq, before we have to let you go, let me just ask you about one other question. Again, our guest is Dr. Tawfiq Hamid, a senior fellow and chair for the study of Islamic radicalism at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies and a former, well, jihadist in Egypt. About this speech by al-Sisi at Al-Azhar, one of the things I was so struck by was when he made this appeal, this challenge to the sort of fundamental problem of our time, which is this global jihadism and the ideology that its adherents at least call Sharia, he did not call out the Islamic State. He did not call out al-Qaeda. He did not call out the Muslim Brotherhood, his arch enemies at the moment. He went, as you say, to the Holy of Holies, really, in Islam, the Al-Azhar University scholars. And he challenged them. And as you say, he not only asked for a revolution, but he really laid at their feet the problem that is afflicting so many inside the Islamic world and out. Why is that of such consequence in your judgment, and what does it portend for his future as well as that of your native Egypt?
First of all, Egypt is a leader in the area. So whatever happens in Egypt, it really it affects the other neighboring countries. So if Egypt reforms, brings another understanding of Islam that can be compatible with our modern civilization, if this happened, all the area can start to change in the same direction. This is number one, because we have very powerful media, and typically Egyptians have influence on the surrounding area. So this can affect Africa, can affect other countries in the Middle East in a positive way. The second is that challenge that Al-Sisi put to the Islamic scholars actually embarrassed them and is pushing them forward to start making some change. I don't know yet if the change will be real and genuine and effective or not, but at least Al-Azhar University just a few days ago declared that they will stop teaching the violent text in their education and they will bring some new curricula from the next year. So this is an immediate effect of Assisi teaching.
I agree with you completely, and this is one of the reasons why the president's investment in the Muslim Brotherhood, as opposed to el-Sisi, is so fraught with peril. Tawfiq Hamid, please do come back to us again very soon. This is a fascinating conversation, and we've much more to learn from you. We appreciate what you do at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies, and we'll look forward to a further visit soon. Diana West is up next. We'll take stock with her of some of these same questions straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Diana West, one of our go-to folks on matters involving Well, the sort of assault on our culture as well as our society and security posed particularly by these ideological enemies of the past and of today. Diana West, of course, is a blogger par excellence. You can find her writings at dianawest.net, the author of two gangbusters books, one Death of the Grown-Up and the other American Betrayal, a secret assault on our nation's character. Diana, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be with you.
So let's take stock. We've just been hearing from Tawfiq Hamid about the mistakes that are being made by the Obama administration in embracing the Muslim Brotherhood, specifically in Egypt, but also here at home. And I wondered what your thoughts were on that as part of the larger set of concerns about what the president was up to at his so-called Countering Violent Extremism Summit last week.
Well, what wasn't the president up to at that summit? I mean, it was such an embarrassment and such a difficult thing to live through as an American. But there was one aspect of it that actually just came out of his op-ed that he used to kick off the summit, where he discussed the notion that what he calls violent extremists, those engaging in global jihad, etc., have legitimate grievances. And this, to me, I think was almost a revolutionary comment coming from a president of the United States. It sounded like a spokesman for one of these groups to talk about legitimate grievances. I found it quite stunning.
Yeah, but this is really of a piece with all of the other things. I mean, the Crusader remark, the apology tour, and more generally kind of the affinity that he's exhibited from everything from the call to prayer to, these brotherhood-related organizations. Diana West, that brings me to a news item today from the Center for Security Policy about a revelation that one of the members of the House Intelligence Committee, Andre Carson, has deep and extensive and longstanding ties to various fronts for the Muslim Brotherhood and, jihadists in America. Groups like the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the Islamic Society of North America, the Islamic Circle of North America, the Muslim American Society, and on, all of whom have established relationships with the Muslim Brotherhood and are, part of, I believe, the global jihad. And yet, we've had the House Minority Leader, Nancy Pelosi, appoint Andre Carson to the House Intelligence Committee. Now, I just wonder what you, as a serious student of penetration of our government and subversion from within dating back to the communist era and its insights for what's happening today, what do you make of this and what should we as a people make of it?
Well, there's something very important that we need to add to our understanding of this. Of course, I find this chilling. The reason I find it chilling is if we go back to the model that was used by the Soviet Union in the 1930s, it was something called Popular Front or People's Front governments, whereby communist agents, secret communists, would become a part of a governing council. This happened prominently in Spain and France, for example, but it arguably happened here as well under the Roosevelt administration, whereby these people are actually serving a non-American entity, whether it was the Soviet Union or global communism, or if we talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, we're talking about a global Islamic movement dedicated to a caliphate in which the United States does not exist. So if we look at this and we see an Andre Carson with ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, we have to question, are we looking at an Islamic front being created out of the House Intelligence Committee with someone who is so closely tied to an international organization and movement, so at odds with the existence of our Constitution and our own nation?
Yeah, no, I mean, putting it a little bit more starkly, using their words, it's not just that they're at odds, that they, don't fancy our approach. The Muslim Brotherhood, as you know, Diana West, according to a document introduced into evidence in the Holy Land Foundation trial by the federal government, actually has our destruction at our own hands as their purpose. So, I mean, this is a serious problem.
No, it's very serious. And again, when you look at them, if you look at the House Intelligence Committee with a representative of the Muslim Brotherhood, let's call it that, and understand it as now a penetrated group. I mean, this is what we're looking at. This is the kind of thing we have to get our minds around, because it's very difficult to, because, of course, this whole way of thinking that people can be working for global movements that are seeking our destruction is something that's been stamped out of us as McCarthyism. We're not supposed to acknowledge that there could be enemies domestic as well as foreign. We're not supposed to ever acknowledge that we can be changed or penetrated or influenced by these actors. So this becomes kind of a leap we have to take, and I suggest studying the precedent as laid out in American Betrayal so that we can see these parallels more clearly and try to do something to stave off disaster.
Yeah. Well, you're making some leaps. I don't know that they're unwarranted based on the evidence that we've compiled, but it does, I think, require us to be reflecting carefully on whether we're adequately attentive to these kinds of relationships and even the possibility that people could be, I don't know, sources of compromises of highly classified information. For example, you know, what the U.S. government is doing, if anything, to try to counter the Muslim Brotherhood in America, or at the very least serve as a kind of influence operator inside the councils of this very important oversight committee at a moment when, you know, the government isn't getting enough of a, I think, scrubbing for what it's doing with respect to outreaching to and enabling of and legitimating of and even underwriting and arming, in some cases, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Right. I mean, yes, it's a historical model that certainly has lessons for today. Yes, and I think that influence is always more important even than breaches of security, because influence has a way of shaping our patterns of behavior as a nation and shaping our ways of defending or not our nation. So these become very long-term and intractable problems of influence. While you might have that member with these ideas discussing the legitimate grievances of ISIS and other groups in the House Intelligence Committee, as the president does. So you can sort of see that we already have some major problems on this same front in terms of what our nation is and what our relation is to these nefarious movements.
Yeah. Well, and it's sufficient to say, as Tafiq Hamid earlier recounted, that part of the tradecraft, and this is a guy, of course, who spent time inside Jamaat Islamiyah, one of the knockoffs of the Muslim Brotherhood in his native Egypt. One of the aspects of tradecraft is that these are always the nicest guys in the room. And I think everyone will doubtless respond to this dossier by saying, oh, this is such a nice guy. I've known him for a long time. He's served with distinction, yada, yada. The point is not how nice he is. The point is, has he put himself in a position, or is he in fact minded, as the president seems to be, for crying out loud, that the Muslim Brotherhood really is a team that we can do business with safely? And if so, that is a huge problem inside an outfit like the Intelligence Committee. Diana West, we are hard out of time and there's so much more to talk about, but we'll look forward to doing so again with you next week as we do each of these visits. Keep up the great work that you're doing at dianawest.net. And of course, please check out American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Next up, we'll speak with Michael Maloof. We'll talk about the administration's unbelievable revelations about future military operations and what that might mean for all of us. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. 25 years ago, then-British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher warned her American counterpart, "This is no time to go wobbly, George," when it came to dealing forcefully with aggression by Saddam Hussein. The same should now be said to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in the face of successive anti-constitutional immigration edicts by President Obama. Senator McConnell yesterday signaled a willingness to try to finesse Democratic objections that have kept the Department of Homeland Security from being funded. Unfortunately, his approach would effectively assure continued presidential trampling of congressional lawmaking prerogatives. House Republicans led by Representative John Duncan are circulating a letter intended to buck up any tempted to go wobbly. Tell your representatives to hold the line on defunding Obama's executive amnesty and other immigration travesties. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
This is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by a colleague and friend of many years, F. Michael Maloof. He is today a senior staff writer for National Security Affairs at WND and also at G2 Bulletin. But before that, for some 30 years or so, he was one of the go-to guys inside the office of the Secretary of Defense on a whole host of issues, notably during my time there in matters involving technology security. In fact, he served as the Director of Technology Security Operations. He is also an author, among other things, of A Nation Forsaken, EMP, The Escalating Threat of an American Catastrophe. We'll talk about that with Michael in the course of our chat. Welcome, sir. It's always good to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Frank. Appreciate it.
You broke a story the other day that I think just is astounding, to the effect that the United States government has telegraphed a punch in terms of what it has in mind for a major campaign in the counter-Islamic State activity in Iraq. Tell us what they've disclosed and what that might portend for that particular operation, Michael Maloof.
Yeah, no, the briefing itself was off the record. It was a teleconference and with Central Command, with a general, Give, and a senior official. And we were astounded when he revealed that they were talking about going after Mosul, getting back Mosul in an April-May time frame. And we've known about Mosul and the desire to take it back. But not only did he lay out the time frame, but he also said, gave details on how many troops it's going to take to actually take back Mosul, from 20 to 25,000. And we're all just standing, sitting there, scratching our heads saying, well, why are you revealing this kind of detail? And the lead up to it was, I think, to show that, and the information he provided beforehand was basically to say, well, ISIS is on the run. ISIS is in a defensive mode. They're actually not regaining territory, even though they took al-Baghdadi and the town. But he said that that's just a temporary thing, but they're not showing significant movement and progress as they did in the lead-up to taking over the caliphate. And then he mentioned that now we're going to go back and take back Mosul, and we're going to do it in this time frame with this many troops, but we're going to have to train these guys. Well, we began scratching our heads some more, and we said, wait a minute. I mean, we've been training Iraqis for years, and then the first time when Mosul fell, some 13,000 troops, Iraqi troops, gave up all of their equipment and ran against an onslaught of only 2,000 invaders and fighters from ISIS. And we wondered, well, how are these guys going to be even ready? And that's one of the lingering issues. Are they even going to be ready? Of course, we're going to be training them as well as Peshmerga. And it's all going to be within this time frame leading up to April, May. Now, the caveat was, well, if they're not ready, then we won't do it. But we want to do it before Ramadan, which this year occurs mid-June.
Now, Michael, let me just ask you, because, again, you are a serious student of these matters. You've spent a lot of time with the military in the Pentagon and elsewhere. Just as a basic matter of principle, isn't this the kind of information you don't want to give the enemy, particularly months in advance? I mean, talk about this in the context of the sort of defense of this disclosure that the Pentagon subsequently gave you, which you've written about at WND.
Well, we were astounded. In fact, we were floored when we heard this level of detail. We basically telegraphed to ISIS that Mosul was on our was definitely going to be hit. This is how we were going to do it. This is how many troops we're going to, and this actually then gives ISIS the opportunity then to reinforce itself. These guys live to die, if you will, because they want to be martyrs, and there's nothing more that they would like than to have a standoff with us. They know they took Mosul in the first place, and they probably think, well, if they're going to be using Iraqi troops and not U.S. troops, we can do what we did before when we took Mosul.
Especially the relatively small number of them, 25,000 people to liberate an entire city really seems to me to be a stretch. You quote Senator Tom Cotton, who is himself an Iraq war veteran.
Yeah, it's a city. Mosul, by the way, is a city of 1.5 million. And we recall the experience we had with taking Fallujah. And that was with U.S. Marines. And that was an incredible effort.
And a smaller city. Talk a little bit about Senator Tom Cotton's response. Tom was a former Iraq war veteran, of course, and he gave you some pretty choice quotes on this subject.
Yeah, he, along with General McNamara, were just absolutely astounded by this. And they believe, I think, that the mission's going to actually fail. That their concern is that it's not going to work. We shouldn't have telegraphed like this, and now we've tipped off the enemy on what we're going to be doing. And they can then make adjustments. They can set up the IEDs, the traps, and just lay out all kinds of tripwires and booby traps for any of the people. Look, when they took over that base where we have Marines just outside of al-Baghdadi, they were actually able to get within the perimeter of the base, and we have 300 Marines there, 320 Marines, who are trainers. Now, the trainers we have there, they're not equipped to deal with combat. They're not trained to be combat soldiers. They're trained as special operators, and they could probably put up a fierce fight, but they're not equipped, nor do they have the backup to deal with an onslaught.
Yeah, this is a point that General Jerry Boykin made to us the other day, that we need to be reinforcing those guys and giving them the capability they need to fight these guys tooth and tong. Michael Maloof, what this really points out, I think, is not only the micromanagement of the Pentagon by the White House, but also its failure to observe even the most basic of security procedures. And it really further raises questions about the president's authorization for the use of military force and, well, more generally, his role as commander-in-chief. Michael Maloof is our guest with WND. You can find terrific reporting on national security matters of all stripes from Michael at WND.com. But, Michael, let me turn to another topic that, as I mentioned, you've focused on intensively and I think very effectively, and that is the vulnerability of our electrical grid. This is an issue that we believe is really of surpassing importance. I know you do as well. What would you say to the president, if you had his ear, about both the need and the feasibility of doing something to address that vulnerability?
Well, I would basically say that the need is absolutely critical. We have an already vulnerable electrical grid system throughout the United States, and it's my information that he's very aware of this, and he could be signing an executive order to DHS today that would basically make EMP or electromagnetic pulse events a matter of national priority to react to in case there is a national emergency to try to avoid any catastrophe or calamity. Because an EMP, a widespread EMP, will definitely impact on all of our critical infrastructures that depend upon the grid and any of our electronic components, and even all of our automated control systems that we have out there and that we take for granted on a daily basis, from running the gas pump to moderating the oil and gas pipelines. We have over 1 million miles of oil and gas pipelines that are basically run by these automated control systems. An EMP would effectively knock those out.
And the point you're making here, I think, is so critical, Michael, is that you're looking at something that could involve a simple nuclear weapon detonated in space over the United States, something that several countries now have the capability to do, and others are seeking to acquire it. We also, of course, have other threats to the grid, more prosaic, sabotage, cyber attacks, radio frequency weapons, and the like. So this is a critical problem, and I can't thank you enough for what you do to raise awareness about it and call for urgent action on it. We agree with you, and our Secure the Grid Coalition at the Center for Security Policy is very appreciative of your work. Michael, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. I appreciate as well your past service to our country in the Pentagon, and I also hope that you will continue to do your great work at WND and come back to us again very soon. Next up, Von Hipp joins us. We'll talk about his new book and what it tells us about how to win the war we're in. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We will never fully understand what we've asked of our military service members, of their families, or their children, asking them to deploy, patrol, stay on watch, on point, asking them to put themselves in harm's way, to endure it all. But we do understand that it's our turn, our duty, to bring them all the way home, to keep them secure, to have their backs for the rest of their lives. Wounded Warrior Project long-term support programs do whatever it takes to help our most severely ill or injured veterans live independently, at no cost, for life, so that they might stand at ease. Find out how you can help at findwwp.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm a firefighter.
A teacher.
I'm a farmer.
I'm a barber.
A waitress.
A mom.
We're all part of your community. Every day we move in and out of each other's busy lives.
It's easy to take for granted all the little moments that make up our everyday.
Some are good,
others not so much.
But that's life. It's when you experience a moment of uncertainty, something or someone's behavior that doesn't seem quite right.
These are the moments to take a pause.
Because if something doesn't feel right, it's probably not.
It's not about paranoia
or being afraid.
It's about standing up and protecting our communities.
One detail at a time.
Because a lot of little details can become a pattern.
We
trust our instincts.
Just like you should.
Because only you know what's not supposed to be in your everyday.
So protect your everyday.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined, I believe, for the first time by Van Hipp, a man who has served with distinction in the senior ranks of the United States military's headquarters, the Pentagon, as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army, responsible, among other things, for reserve forces and mobilization during Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm, a critical time which tested both our reserve forces and mobilization to the max. He was also a former Principal Deputy General Counsel of the United States Navy. In other walks of life, he has chaired the South Carolina Republican Party. Today, he is the chairman of America Defense International, a Washington-based consulting firm, and the author of a new book, The New Terrorism, How to Fight It and Defeat It. Van Hipp, welcome. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Frank, it's great to be with you.
Well, I'm particularly pleased because, of course, fighting and defeating terrorism is something that we're rather keen on around here. So it's great to have somebody with a plan and to have a chance to visit a little bit with you. Let's maybe start with the catalog of very troubling, well, vulnerabilities or maybe axes of attack that these terrorists might use against this country, and sort of a net assessment of how serious a risk we find ourselves in at the moment.
I really believe that the world is more dangerous today than it was after 9/11, Frank. Radical Islam is the fight of our time, the challenge of our time. And when we look at the vulnerabilities of this country, cybersecurity, the border, the bio threat, the electromagnetic pulse threat, there's no one magic bullet to solve all these problems. It's going to take a combination of things. And the problem is, as technology changes, the bad guys also have access to the technology. But the government, as you know, is so stovepipe, and it takes us so long to respond. And it's almost as if as technology increases, so do the threats almost exponentially.
Right. And to the extent that you have really teased out, I think, in considerable detail, some of these challenges in your new book, The New Terrorism, Van, how would you rank, for example, the problem of our vulnerable electric grid to one or the other of these lines of attack? Is that something that keeps you up at night?
Well, the electromagnetic pulse attack is a very real threat. And the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum makes a very convincing case, and we point this out in my book, that the North Koreans may have already obtained an EMP nuclear warhead. And as you know, one burst at a sufficiently high altitude, it can knock out our grid. Studies show that after a year, we could lose almost half the population. The farmers can't grow enough food to feed the American people without electricity. And if people say, well, you're just a fear monger and so forth, look at what NASA says, Frank. NASA says that it is inevitable in the next 10 to 100 years we will have another Carrington effect, a geomagnetic storm on the sun, also knocking out our grid. So the EMP threat is real. I would say this, though. What we are most unprepared for as a nation is the cyber threat, the cyber attack. And it's almost like death by a thousand hacks.
It is indeed. And I think what you've put your finger on, Van Hip, in terms of the magnitude of the damage that could be done, perhaps with the click of a mouse or the explosion of a nuclear weapon in space or perhaps other means, is truly catastrophic for the nation. Talk, you would, a little bit about this idea of separating, as you call it, the death cult from the rest of Islam. As you're looking at this this global jihadist enterprise, how do you do that? And to what effect do you think is possible?
It's very tough. One thing that I call for, we need to reform and moderate Muslims who have the guts to come forward with actionable intelligence to thwart terrorist attacks. You know, right now, King Abdullah, someone I've known, I first met him 20 years ago. We've got an opportunity here where a moderate Muslim is trying to take the fight to radical Islam. We've got to stand with people like King Abdullah and give him everything that he needs.
Yeah. This would be King Abdullah of Jordan.
Yes, King Abdullah of Jordan.
Yeah. Not to be confused with the King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, who's no longer with us. That's a very important point. I think probably we'll find some disagreements about exactly how you define these people, but that's part of the challenge here. But at the very least, empowering those who are not seeking to destroy us is to be much preferred over what we seem to be doing, which is mostly empowering those who are trying to destroy us.
Absolutely. And look, for example, the mosque in Fairfax. Oh, my gosh. You had two or three of the 9/11 hijackers there.
Dar al-Hijra Mosque.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Anwar al-Awlaki.
One person. Anwar al-Awlaki. Also, the head of the Islamic Society of Boston, who went there. I can go on and on. What if just one person had had the guts to come forward there? And think about the attacks and the terrorist activity that could have been thwarted. Political correctness is killing us, right? Political correctness is killing us.
Yeah, just, Van, because I think you're going this place, and I just want to take you there. How are enemies of this country perceiving this political correctness? Do you think this is actually having the effect of emboldening them as they see us, well, submitting?
Oh, I think it is. We're seeing all the wrong signals. As I mentioned the last book at the Nixon Library, and I mentioned, you know, we saw what happened in France recently. Don't forget Saeed al-Jazeera, the imam who called for the assassination of the Danish cartoonist Kurt Westergaard. We caught him, Frank, in the back of a trunk of a BMW trying to come into this country through Mexico. We send all the wrong signals.
No, we do. And this really just comes back to your point about the importance of border security as well, Van Hip, in your new book, The New Terrorism, How to Fight It and Defeat It. You emphasize, and I think it's really important that this be stressed, not just the borders of the country as we think of them north and south, but also the maritime borders, the ports and harbors of this country. Talk a little bit about that as a priority for, you know, a serious national security posture.
I think this is a real vulnerability. I spoke with a former commander of two minesweepers, and we talk about this in the book. I was surprised to learn that we have no mine countermeasure capability in either the Gulf of Mexico or on the Atlantic coast. One of the things that I call for is to have use autonomous underwater vehicles to do a periodic sweep, if you will, of the cure routes of our harbors and ports to look for underwater IEDs and so forth. There are 250,000 mines right now in the world, and I think this would go a long way to securing our ports, our harbors. And as you know, the bad guys, it's all about inflicting damage also on the American economy. You shut down one major port in this country, and you've caused grave danger to the American economy.
Yeah, well, the evidence is upon us at the moment with this recent job action in the ports of the West Coast is just slowing things down, let alone putting them out of business for protracted periods of time, is having a crippling effect on large parts of the economy. Let me take advantage in our closing minute with you, if I may, Van Hip, as a former senior official in the United States Navy. You've touched there on something that's of great concern to me. Do you think we are adequately resourcing the United States Navy for both the power projection missions that it's traditionally performed, but also for assuring, you know, the security of our own nation here at home?
No, we're not. And one thing, for example, the Aegis ballistic missile defense system, great for defending against the way it's currently equipped. For short-range missiles, we need to be able to equip the Aegis ballistic missile defense capability to be able to counter intercontinental ballistic missiles. That's just one example right there that we point out in the book. And we do not have a land-based missile defense system on the East Coast. That's another thing we talk about in the book.
You've covered so much, and we've only just skimmed the surface. Van Hip, I hope you'll come back, and maybe we can do a full hour with you to really tease some of these things out and help the rest of us understand both the vulnerabilities and some of the very practical solutions that you offer in The New Terrorism, How to Fight It and Defeat It. We look forward to a conversation with you along those lines soon. We look forward to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.